Log Talk Radio.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Kay Thompson Live Show. It's Wednesday at 8 p.m. on the 9th, I guess it's the 9th of August, and we've been off for a couple of weeks doing some things, and we're back talking about all the stuff that whatever we want to talk about. I'm known as the son. My name is Eric Payne, and you are?
I'm Kay Thompson, and I'm your mother, as a matter of fact. And, you know, God, the weather turned out very nicely today. Very nice today. Not as hot as it's been. And we are going to be talking to Wayne Gilman and Byron Saunders and Eric Payne. Because the fact that what we're going to be doing today, we're going to be talking to the people on the show because I personally want you to know who you're talking to and a little bit about their background, how they came to be who they are. We've had some very exciting programs. But I figured that why not have people who are on the show, you know, talk about their backgrounds and what their views are, and then we can go from there. Everybody that we have on the show, you know, we all have some pretty interesting backgrounds. So, Eric, we want to start with you, you know. So.
That's good.
I want to start with my son, Eric. I want to know, the people want to know who you are. You know, a lot of people know who you are because you are an actor. You are an actor, and you're doing a whole lot of other things involving, you know, the theater and a lot of exciting things, which we're going to be talking about when it gets straight and when things get in order, and it's very exciting. So, but right now I want to talk about you. I want to talk about Wayne, or to Wayne and Byron, and they're going to be calling in a little while. You have it?
Yeah, let's go to open the Byron, resident guest story, and like that. Hey, Byron, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. I'm anxious to hear your story, Eric.
Yeah. My story, yeah. Well, I'm not one to be talking about this. So if you see the description of the thing, I put that we'll be talking about. I'll share some stories behind the scenes. Started my career with Spike Lee a long time ago. I started out being an actor by trade, went to school for acting. What else? Went to school for acting, met Spike Lee a long time ago, and started working with him. Some behind-the-scenes things that I could describe. So started my career, working as an actor, but, you know, a lot of people come out acting, and you never know if you're going to be good enough or what it's going to be. As I was doing some local plays, I met one person doing a play with me, another actor, who happened to be from Howard University. Went to your alma mater, I think that is, Byron, Howard University, right? Did you go to Howard?
Hampton.
You went to Hampton. Oh, I knew there was something about you.
I'm a graduate of Hampton, class of 73.
I knew there was something about you that I liked, brother. That's where I went to. I think we were both there. If I was there when it was called Hampton Institute, I think you were there when it was called Hampton Agricultural. Like that.
See that?
Shortly after
Bucky
right? You know, and now it's university, but. I don't know what the theater department was like when you were there, but when I was there, it was the class that I came in was the largest class of theater majors at the time. A couple of my classmates are Ruth Carter, who was an Oscar-nominated costume designer, Robbie Reed, who's a very well-known casting actors, and there's a number of other people, Michael Ralph, who's a good friend of mine, brother of Cheryl Lee Ralph, has appeared on the Bernie Mac Show, A Different World, and things like that. So, you know, when you go to one of the our schools, as opposed to an NYU or what they call the league schools, which would be the Juilliards and the Yale and the Harvards and NYUs, you pretty much don't have the advantages of coming out of college with an agent and things like that. So, as I said, I was doing local theater. and met a guy who went to Howard, who came over to Jersey, was acting in a play. He went to Howard. And as we got to know each other and became friends, he said, hey, I got a play that we're going to do over here. Would you be interested in being in it? It's about college, about school. Takes place at predominantly African-American, a college that, like, we went to. It was written by one of his classmates, by a brother by the name of Gerard Brown. I don't know if you know Gerard. Byron, he's about your age. I think you might have mentioned that you knew Bobby Caldwell, too. Ajumu, they call him now.
Sure, and Ruthie Carter and all those people you named, because I was there a little bit ahead of you.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm thinking Howard. I keep thinking you're a Howard guy. But anyway.
I knew Howard. Yeah, right. I grew up in D.C.
Right. Okay, so there you go. So I met this brother who went to Howard, and his partner was a playwright who wrote a play about being at the black school, and it was called Jonah, which at that time, I guess, yeah, you know, being from D.C., is a colloquialism for playing the dozens. And in this play, it kind of gets out of hand at these frat members, I played a guy in the frat. And what happens is it kind of gets out of hand, and my character, as a result, basically ends up committing suicide, because as we find his backstory, he's got some issues with his family, uncle who was head of the university. So we did this play off Broadway, and someone told someone that worked for Joseph Papp at the time. And Joseph Papp, the New York Shakespeare Festival, founder of the Public Theater in New York City. You know, Public Theater has a very storied history in terms of bringing new and interesting theater out when Joe first started it, I guess maybe in the 60s or maybe in the late 70s. So Joseph Papp, his wife hears about it first. She comes to see the play. We're performing off Broadway on 54th Street at a theater called the American Theater of Actors. And then Joe Papp comes to town to see the play. And he had heard so much about it, he had just gotten off a plane from overseas, I think Europe or Russia, ironically where he was, came to see the show, liked the show, and decided to pick it up and take us then to the step off Broadway, which is the step right before you go to Broadway, and bring us to the Public Theater. And they requested that definitely a certain number of actors stay with the show, come with the show, and they didn't care about whoever else. They allowed the director and the producer to pick who they wanted to bring. Fortunately, I was one of the people that they said they wanted to definitely bring with the show. And it kind of told me that I had what it takes at least to be an actor if someone of the stature of Joseph Papp chose me as one of the people to come and perform in this play. So then, as it turns out, the writer of the show was good friends with Ernest Dickerson, who also went to Howard. Ernest Dickerson at that time had just gotten out of NYU with Spike Lee. They come see the play. I get a call from someone. I come home one day, and my sister left a message that a guy named Spike called you, saw you in the play, wants you to come audition for a movie he has. And so I thought my sister Lisa, who often sometimes gets information a little mixed up, I said, come on, the guy's name is Spike? Get out of here. So she said, yeah, that's what he said. So I called him up, and I said, can I speak to Spike? He said, yeah, Eric, saw you in the play that Gerard wrote, Jonah, and I got a movie I want to do. I want you to come audition. So I go and meet Spike Lee, go in to audition for this film, and he gives me a script, tells me to read it, come back. And I read a couple scenes while I was there. And he says, so when I get home, he gives me the script. So I thought that I got the role. He said, read the script, man. I called him up. I said, did I get the role? Does this mean I have the role? He said, read the script, then come back. So I prepared some scenes, read the script, went back. We never went over anything. We just ended up talking. Found out he went to Morehouse. I went to Hampton. We talked a little bit, and I had the role. And basically, this movie called Messenger, about a bicycle messenger whose mother passed away and whose father eventually became involved with a white woman, married the woman, and how the kids dealt with that whole transition, was basically about Spike Lee's life. It's autobiographical. And we were in rehearsal for 2 weeks, myself and Spike Lee. In the film, he had a girlfriend, and the woman who was playing my girlfriend was Tracy Johns, Nola Darling, and She's Gotta Have It. The weekend before we were supposed to start shooting the movie, the producer said, I don't have the money. we can't shoot the movie. So during this 2 weeks, Spike and I became good friends because it was just him and myself that would be in rehearsal. And so he revamped and ended up writing She's Gotta Have It. That's how that happened. Now, in the original cast members, in that original version of Messenger, which eventually became Crooklyn, which was Spike's third or fourth film, he had an actor playing the role that I was going to play. He had all union actors, Screen Actors Guild actors. And the actor that was supposed to play the role, and let me backtrack. They had to drop out because he couldn't get a SAG waiver. And so these union actors had to drop out. The guy who was supposed to be playing the role that I was going to play was none other than now my good friend Giancarlo Esposito. The guy that was supposed to play his best from Breaking Bad, that's right, and many other movies. Giancarlo's got a great long career. The guy that was supposed to be playing his best friend in the movie was Lawrence Fishburne. Mm. And everybody knows who Lawrence Fishburne is on Blackish now, but a great number of movies. And the person who was supposed to be playing his little brother in the movie was Kadeem Hardison, who went on to different world fame. So it's interesting how this worked out, because after She's Gotta Have It came out, Spike put me in the movie. Ironically, what happened was that a lot of the crew members were going to attempt to bring some sort of lawsuit against Spike to get paid for back wages. And they called me up, tried to get me to join this collective suit, and I just rejected it because I had become friendly with him. And I didn't, as I told the person, I didn't really think that, you know, he was trying to fool anybody or intentionally meant that to happen. It just happened that the money didn't come through. So he ended up doing She's Gotta Have It. He gave me a role in She's Gotta Have It. He gave me a role in School Days, in which I ended up working with Lawrence Fishburne, Giancarlo, and Kadeem. Kadeem and I became very good friends. Now, people may ask, well, why wasn't I in Do the Right Thing? Somewhere along the line between the success and becoming very successful, you know, friendships kind of fall out a little bit, and misunderstandings happen. So that's why if you see Do the Right Thing and I'm just playing an extra, I was trying to make up for some kind of misunderstandings and things like that. And so our careers kind of went different ways. Ironically, Spike Lee ended up producing a film that I had with some other guys called The Session, a short film, which went on to become Drop Squad, starring Eric LaSalle, Ving Rhames, Bonnie Curtis Hall, myself, Leonard Thomas. So those were the beginnings of my career and stuff like that. Ed, you wanted to say something, Rob?
Yes, I do. Now, how about this... Byron.
Yes.
Byron.
Okay.
Byron?
I'm right here.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to, you know, ask Eric? Because I'm really holding the reins tight tonight.
Sure.
I want to know, wait a minute. I want to know about each of you. Please, you'd be surprised. A lot of people don't know what you've done. I mean, you guys have some really big history, some very impressive history. And so I want people to know that you know what you're talking about and when you talk about different things. Now, naturally, we're talking about Trump. Dump Trump, okay?
Right,
we knew
right.
about a lot of it because we were, you know, over at WIBBOS, we were right down the street from the Trump Tower. So we're going to get into that later, but he's all over the news. I don't want to hear about him. What about you or Eric? You know, what's up
yeah,
another
yeah,
thing?
I think, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take this.
Yes, you did. This is what we do, you know. You know, we do a little fussing here, and it's so funny because, you know, being the mother, I have to exert my motherly rights. Now, Eric, you were saying.
Yeah, Byron. Yeah. So what I found is that our careers can tend to overlap. You know, it's kind of 6 degrees of separation. When you're starting to work on things, right? And I know that you expressed, like, maybe we might have discussed having gone to Hampton. I didn't know that. I think maybe we mentioned that before, and I've forgotten it. But also, you are an actor as well, right? And some of the people that I mentioned, you also worked with as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, speaking of Hampton, that's where I first met, because Marjorie Moon was my theater instructor, my drama instructor in that class. Michael Pinckney was one of our class members, and all Don Bryan and so many other people that you know that as the class went on, because you came a little bit after me, but they're still my closest of friends. And, you know, the crisscrossing of our 6 degrees of separation is that both you and I are good friends of Monty Ross, who is a producer for Spike Lee. Being at Hampton, and here's a good question, because being at Hampton, that connection to Spike Lee goes through not just, you know, obviously Bill Lee, his father, the bassist, but through his sister, Consuela Morgan, who was in the music department at Hampton. And I'm sure while you were there, the connections and opportunities to make friends with some of the folks that have now become your peers and close friends have guided and allowed you to kind of navigate through this entertainment industry. And as a result of that, I guess the question to ask is where we are in our entertainment industry now, with respect to those mutual connections that we've had, do you feel as if this is our moment of shining opportunities? Because those films and people that you just named, they seem to be the cream of the crop of the entertainment industry for which we are a part of. Your comment.
Yeah, I certainly think that the groundwork was laid early on by the Spikes and the Robert Townsends and some of the work that we did, certainly. You know, just by chance and history's sake, I was fortunate to be in some landmark African-American films that are historic in their own nature. The first School Days was the first film about African-American colleges, if not ever, but to come along certainly in a long time. Spike Lee being the hottest black director to come along in a number of years. The whole She's Got to Have It issue, where you're dealing with a woman who was kind of approaching her sex life like a man, was something that even that was also a little bit revolutionary in terms of feminists and how women, you know, were often supposed to adopt a certain perspective, and men, it was double standard, you know.
Right.
If I could backtrack a little bit, you know, as I said, that Gerard Brown, who wrote Jonan, who was good friends with Ernest Dickerson, who was in film school with Spike Lee. When I met Ernest Dickerson, after the fact, we found out that we were like cousins, because his mother happened to be a lady named Jackie Dickerson, who was good friends with one of my aunts and used to come to my grandmother's house, and I would see her at my aunt's house as well, and I called her Aunt Jackie, and come to find out that that was Ernest's mom, and he was from Newark as well. And so fast forward, when the pivotal film Juice, which made Tupac Shakur star, which was written by Gerard Brown and Ernest Dickerson. Ernest put me in that film, and I have a great scene in that, which really kind of, I like to say, it got me my street cred with the hip-hop kids, because they all seem to remember the scene that I did in Juice, which incidentally had its 25th anniversary of being out. I can't believe it's been 25 years since it came out. At the Schomburg Museum about earlier in July, in the beginning of July, they had a screening and discussion and announced the Blu-ray edition coming out of Juice. Now, when they first wrote this movie, I was old enough to play the lead role in Juice, you know. I mean, this was like 1984, and I was about 24 years old, and after we worked on Jonan and did that, they let Gerard Brown had a script for me to read. Said, check this out. Ernest and I wrote this. And it was Juice. And I wanted, if I had the money at the time, would have produced the film myself. Because I was like, hey, let's do this movie. But it took them another 5 or 6 years before they were able to get the movie done. And then I had to play, obviously, a guy in his 30s, which was around the age that I was. But still to be a part of that. And my relationship, obviously, with Ernest, we call each other cousin. And he's hired me several times. One movie that we were watching the other night is a movie called Never Die Alone, starring now check this out, starring DMX. DMX, who they were trying to make into the new Tupac, or to fill the void left by Tupac when he died, they were trying to push DMX in that position. And so here I am in this movie with this guy as well. A lot of people, since we're talking about Tupac, I'll just talk about the first day I met him, was on the set of Juice. I went to visit, and there was the scene where they had him up against the wall and the other gang members had the knife in his nose. And he came over to the director's chair after they said cut. I was like, and my cousin introduced me to him. And I said, wow, brother, that looked for real. That looked really real, that scene. He said, it felt real. Shoot. You know? And there was another guy in this scene who, if you watch the people, anybody interested in watching the movie Juice, there's another guy who looked really gangster that was in the part of the gang that was threatening Tupac. And I said to my cousin, I was like, wow, that guy looks like he's a real thug. Who's that guy? He said, well, he's actually from Jersey. That's one of your homeboys. And it happened to be Tretch from Naughty by Nature, the hip-hop group.
How about that?
Yeah, how about that? The most gangster-looking guy over there was from right over here from the area I lived in, which shows you how much that we're. I'm going to bring in Mr. Wayne Gilman here to the discussion. Hello, Wayne. How are you
today? Hey, good evening, Eric. I see we've been going down memory lane tonight, and forgive my tardiness, but I have my days confused. You know, when you get to my age, you'll understand that.
Oh, listen, Wayne, now you know what's going on. You know, I'm telling you that I want people to know who the host, the co-hosts are here on Quezon Salon. And Eric was against this because I don't want to say that he was shy. He wasn't shy. I don't think he I'm getting such a big kick out of it because he loves it. I know he loves it because he is an actor, okay, and he's great.
Oh.
And so I'm just getting – I'm really tickled because he's taking this and running with it, you know.
It's interesting because I've seen some of Eric's work, but I didn't know how extensive – you know, one's work is until you hear some people recall what they've been through. And I'm just saying, oh, yeah, I remember that, and I remember this and all that. And, you know, it's healthy. And, I mean, there's so much artistic activity going on in Jersey, and particularly in the Newark area, that there are often times when I think New York pales – from a black perspective in comparison. I could be deadly wrong. Somebody could turn around and call or whether, you know, roundly criticize me. But, you know, I remember going to the event that we attended a couple of months ago there at the, can't even think of the building, but, you know, the forum that we had that evening with the playwright. And I, you know, I just found it so fascinating. And I'm not saying that these things don't occur.
It's a new building.
I mean, Eric just mentioned the Schomburg. I mean, they go on, but, you know, for some reason, I just don't think it gets the kind of recognition that it once did back in the day here in this side of the river.
Now, Wayne, but let me get this back to you. You're not going to get away with, you know, talking about yourself. Of course you know that, right? Wayne Gilman. Wayne Gilman was the director of news. He was the head of the news department. And we clashed
right.
One time, and we became very, very, very tight. And he was the one who was bringing in all these different stories. And, you know, some of the stories, for instance, well, my good friend was Sonny Carson. And when I told people that, they said, oh, because everybody told me the police were afraid of Sonny Carson. I couldn't figure out why. But anyway, that's a whole difference. But Wayne Gilman, director of the news department, it was a heavy-duty thing.
Let me just say really, really briefly, and then I want to go back to Byron and get, because I think some of the people I know, but you mentioned Sonny Carson, okay?
Yeah.
Now, I did Juice with an actor named Ronnie Clanton, who was in the Juice movie, who played Sonny Carson in the movie The Education of Sonny Carson.
Right.
So, and if you know the Sonny Carson story, Sonny Carson used to be a gang member back in the day. And now also talking about the Negro Ensemble Company, which was the mecca for a lot of black actors, you know, trying to work at the Negro Ensemble Company. Friends that I eventually met, Charlie Weldon, tried to audition for Douglas Turner Award. And your good friend that you grew up with, Barbara Montgomery, was a member of that you and Aunt Pat knew. And Byron, I believe you did some work with some of those folks from the Negro Ensemble Company. Would that be correct, or was it the Henry Street?
Absolutely. Running Just Us Theater Company in Atlanta, Georgia, I was able to bring the Negro Ensemble Company to my theater in Atlanta with Nevis Mountain Dew, which had the cast of Cass, Barbara Montgomery, Sam Art Williams. I mean, it was the who's who. Okay, and
I did
then,
that in college. I did that at Hampton, Nevis Mountain Dew.
And then was able to bring them back to Atlanta to Just Us Theater with Home with Michelle Shea, Carol Millard,
right,
and Sam
Brown.
Jackson, who, by the way, was one of the people who started Just Us Theater. So it was like him coming back home to star in Atlanta in Sam Art Williams' play Home. It was amazing. And we have these connections, definitely.
Right.
And, you know, when I get to my side of the story, I'll tell you more. But, I mean, Eric, it's amazing how we have been crisscrossing each other and following each other's paths so many times. And, of course, now we are absolutely working together on K Thompson Live. It's really a nice journey.
How you came.
And I have to ditto that too, Byron. You know, from the first time I met you, you know, I really acknowledged and recognized a lot of talent there, and it's just amazing how sometimes, you know, people, you either work against them, compete against them sometimes, and, you know, fate will have it in such a way that everyone comes together on the same page. And I just think that's very important.
Good, Bob. You want to say?
But listen, I want to ask Byron, what did you do before you came to my show? Okay.
Go back even further than that, you were in school, you majored in drama, speech and drama, I think. I don't know if it was the same major, but you wanted to be an actor, or how did the career progress?
Well, I transferred from the University of Kansas in 1971 to Hampton in the spring semester on the last day of late registration. My godmother, Beryl Pierce, was godmother's daughter, Beryl Pierce, went to Virginia Union, and her husband was a graduate of Hampton, said, well, you know, maybe you should come on down to Hampton. And at that point, I was like, oh, okay, what the heck? And so on the very last day of late registration, I got in. And I came in as a second semester junior at Hampton, I spent an extra year after losing a few credits and then finally getting my act together. But what I really learned was being able to come into the speech and drama department. Oh, I was having a lot of fun. You know, Hampton is paradise. You got to know, you know. And for a lot of good reasons, it's paradise. There were more women in our theater, speech and drama department than there were men. So, you know, we were enjoying a true paradise. Okay, enough of that. But
amen,
getting to,
Byron.
And that's why, Eric, you got to co-sign on that. You know what I'm talking about, because in the speech and drama department, there was this amazing talent of young artists and men and women who virtually have stepped into the light and are the premier entertainment industry actors and actresses today.
Byron.
So anyway,
Byron.
I was there.
Byron?
Yes.
Byron, I want to jump
yes.
in right here. Now that we're still on Hampton for about two more minutes, okay? I'm going to tell something about Eric. You know, he had to take a class of, you know, exercise or dance class. He just loved it. And when I asked him, I said, boy, you really like this dancing. You never liked dancing before. He said, yeah, but I get to hold girls.
I was
that's a secret.
I was a Terpsichorean. I joined the Terpsichorean.
Oh,
I built the Terpsichoreans, of course. Absolutely.
So go ahead.
I auditioned for them, indeed. I mean, it's one of those things you did when you were down in the speech and drama department, and the instructor was a stunningly beautiful African-American woman, and, of course, all the dancers there, they needed some male dancers. So, Eric, I salute your steadfastness and honor to join the Terpsichoreans. So in 1971, which is kind of interesting, Eric, did you know that Bob Johnson – of BET fame was a class of 72 at Hampton.
Oh,
and
what?
Yes, That's right. And in my senior year in the class of, in 1973, my senior, I was a member of the Hampton Players. We were at a Caramel House in Cleveland doing a winter fall semester where we went there for several weeks, performed on their main stage doing Imari Baraka's Slave Ship on their main stage. And while we were there, we were trying to decide, well, what we're going to do as seniors once we graduate, because back in that time period, the median income range for a graduating speech and drama major all across America was only $2,500 a year. So you know you weren't going to either be teaching, or if you're going to go into the profession, you're going to be serving tables and working odd jobs to support your notion. So we at that time in January in Cleveland, snowy Cleveland, decided that we would come back to Hampton and start what for our senior project, a soap opera called It's a Bet, where we would develop a program of writing a soap opera about three families. The main family grew up in Washington, D.C., and the son, Jeff Bett, was at Amherst College, would transfer to Hampton. And we would detail and chronicle his journey being at Hampton. So every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we created what was called the Lunchbox Theater and invited the campus to come and sit in the little theater, which we created a little theater called Lunchbox Theater, where they could come and bring their lunch and watch a 45-minute to an hour soap opera that was originally written by us, the senior students, and come and watch it. Well, it went on. It was such a success that ultimately we tried. One of the real reasons was we wrote it was to try to merge the mass media department's television concept and teaching those students to work with the theater students to create a market for what we were doing. And ultimately, it's kind of interesting because Eric, once I graduated in 73, Talmadge White and Fitz Houston and others continued it. It actually went on beyond the graduating senior class, so that you may have been a part of that. Any event, after I graduated and came to Washington, D.C., I worked at the Folger Shakespeare Library and Theater Company. I did a national audition at the arena stage, and I got a contract to work at the Folger, teaching Shakespeare in the D.C. public high schools and working there. But one of the things that is incredible to note is that I went to BET at that time and pitched the idea of selling the soap opera, which we called It's a Bet, to them. And they told me at that time they could only produce the MTV format talking heads and that they didn't have enough money to do local originated programming, which is quite interesting because when you realize that Tyler Perry just signed with Viacom to do programming at BET, he's going to bring new programming to BET. I find that quite interesting. But 40-some years ago, we had already pitched it.
Well, times have changed. You know, I'm just not to cut you off, Byron, and I have a quick question. I'm a little jealous sitting back listening.
Wayne, listen, let's go to you first. And then you can come back to Byron, and you know, you can do the talk.
Okay.
But
I'll hold it right
Wayne,
there.
You were the Wayne, you were the director of the news department, and there was a lot of stuff going on around in the news department, and various people. And various things that were going on. So how about revealing some of the stuff before I was revealed?
Well, you threw me for a curve there, Kay, but there were so many different stories that we covered over the years. And I don't want to get started with Trump because, it just seems like the decadence that we're living now is just symptomatic of some of the things that we lived through back then. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, the whole nation now, the world is now exposed to this man's, infantile behavior. And it's dangerous.
unfortunate, but let's table it. But I want to know, the real question is, and kind of we're getting short on time, that's why I wanted to get into Wayne's, your kind of how you came to WBLS is mine. Because I grew up, you know, hearing your name on the on WBLS Cube, even before my mother came over to WLIB, and how that ended up, how your journey ended you up.
Quick story. I was at Queens College. I was pushing a taxi cab at night. In short order, my last fare from Wall Street to the Port Authority in Manhattan stabbed me in the back. And my and amongst my the fare prior to that happened to be this guy. I don't even know if he's still breathing. His name is Hank Schnowy. Back in the early 70s, he was a big wig at Westinghouse Broadcasting, and he was nice enough to give me an opportunity. Him and Ed Records gave me an opportunity to write copy for WINS. Worked at WINS after I was hospitalized, and at that episode, I vowed never to drive a cab again, including Uber, although the thought has crossed my mind. I went from there, and the late, great Percy Sutton started started planning his empire in the early 70s. And it was a woman that used to be the editor at 1010 Winds, Marge Mealy. He brought some copy to me one day and said, you know, Wayne, this could be an opportunity for you. And I don't mention it enough, and it's not to say that I have anything against but David Lampel, who was one of the original owners of the former Inner City Broadcasting Corporation, I befriended him. He got me through the door. I learned a lot of things from David that, in fact, I'd like to say David was ahead of his time because a lot of the things that you see on TV today, Roger Ailes took a lot of credit for. You know, David largely did the same things in radio before reporter advocacy, that sort of thing. And from there on, you know, it went there, and I've been grateful, and I'm blessed. You know, I mean, it wasn't always you know, smooth sailing, as your mother could probably tell you. But when I look back now, you know, it's I have a different perspective about that. But I don't know, if we ever get back to the acting aspect, I have two questions for both Eric and Byron particularly. That's my story.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, with the questions?
Yeah.
You know, I tell you, I felt a little jealous because I went to CUNY up here in New York. I went to Queens College. And, again, my interest was journalism, wasn't acting. But I don't remember ever any of the CUNY schools offering anything with regard to the arts. And my familiarity with the arts was through a friend of mine, Gerard Cadis, whose cousin is Lenny Wilkins, former coach of the New York Knicks. He introduced me to the Negro Ensemble. At that time, Douglas Turner Ward, Robert Hooks, Angela Bassett, Lawrence Fishburne, Rosalind Cash, who I met. All these people were like, you know, starting out, but they were, you know, I was just compelled and so inspired by what I used to see. But, you know, it wasn't something encouraged in the schools. And I think in a way this is the difference between attending a black school and going to, you know, like your local community college. I feel that listening to both you and Byron, I feel robbed. I don't know if you understand what I'm talking about.
You were. You were.
Yeah, I guess I was, right. Because, I mean, there's a lot – I think there's a lot more longevity in what you guys did. And I'm not knocking what I did. I mean, you know, your mother and I have our place in history. But – I know what I want to say. Maybe, you know, I'm not expressing myself properly.
No. I think that, well, you know, Hampton was known for having, first off, like Byron said, a really great media department. I agree with you, Byron, that they should have been merged. I often wondered that while I was down there, that the merging of the speech and drama department and the media department would have been really good if they could have done a lot more co-productions. But Hampton is known for having really an excellent media department. In Armstrong Hall, I was down there, as you know, Byron. A little tidbit of information. You mentioned Bob Johnson, head of BET. Fast forward about 20, 30 years later, he was really good friends after he founded BET and became the global multimillionaire he was. He ended up having a really good friendship with my uncle, Donald Payne Sr., with Congressman.
Yes.
And they ended up being really good friends. Also, really quickly, I had a friend by the name of Dennis Hines, who I met in college down there. And I kind of recognized this guy as being kind of a child actor. Turned out he was in Buck and the Preacher. He played the kid in Buck and the Preacher. Also had a number of jobs.
Yeah.
Dennis's mother was the great Teresa Merritt, who was at that school, who played Mama on the TV show That's My Mama. Originated the role of Ma Rainey in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. First play.
Yeah.
And so, Byron, you talk about Just Us. I know that Bill Nunn might have come through there as well, because the Morehouse, that whole crew that was working down there too. You talk about Sam Jackson and Sam met his wife, LaTanya Richardson, down there.
LaTanya.
And you know, it was a great experience for us. I don't know if you guys had the I'm getting a brain freeze now. There was a particular question I was going to ask you, and I forgot about it. But the messages and the encouragement that I got in being an all-black school that gave me my a little encouragement about a sense of self-worth was really beneficial to me in coming out in the world and trying to be an actor. I don't know if you felt that way too. Did you, Byron?
Absolutely did, because being out at the University of Kansas, where I went out there from Washington, D.C., to major in pre-law and political science, When I first went out there, the very first day that I was there, my engagement was in a protest sit-in at the local Holiday Inn for wages for the wait staff and for the maids that were working there, because they were totally underpaid and, you know, overworked as usual. And because of social activism, I realized that Kansas was 10 years behind everything. And you know, and they still are. If you look at what's going on in Kansas today, politically and socially, you still have those same dynamics and understanding. I've met white people for the first time who had never seen black people in their entire life.
Right,
you know,
that's
true. Kind of an anomaly when you think about it, because growing up in the big cities, we're surrounded by a lot of everybody. And the school that I went to in D.C. was a Catholic military academy where we were only 65 blacks and the rest were all white students. So, I mean, it's ultimately being in that kind of environment and then being a byproduct of my mother being a graduate of Fisk University, my father and her mother being a graduate of Fisk University, and my father being a graduate of Tennessee State University, I was born at Meharry Hospital in Nashville. So I came out of that experience. And then being able to come back to it at Hampton was – like coming back home. I felt that it was an experiential moment.
Why wasn't Hampton your first choice? Because, I mean, Byron, you and I are the same age or about the same age. How come you didn't consider Hampton first? Were you caught up in that stuff that I know my parents, I mean, God bless them, they were great people, but I think there was a perception that if you attended a black college, it wasn't the same thing as going to, you know, a regular, I mean, I'm not even talking to Ivy League, just a community college or a city college or what have you.
Well, I understand the question, Wayne, because going to the University of Kansas, I did two things. I escaped being in Washington, D.C. at that time, being politically active and having parents who worked for the National Security Agency and who were at the March on Washington. And I went to the Poor People's Campaign. I just kind of realized that going to Kansas, which was considered the Harvard on the Kaw River, was an opportunity to be elevated. Our parents, like you, Wayne and Eric, our parents worked extremely hard to give us these opportunities, and because they could afford it, we are the Dubois would call the talented tenth. And so it was expected of us to excel beyond. But
right.
there's no place like home. There's no place an environment
exactly.
like Hampton.
Let me just get
and Howard.
Use this as a great. That's right. Let me use this as a great segue. Two things. My mother was actually at the March on Washington with Dr. King's speech with my dad. And secondly, your friend, your long-term time friend, Gus Henningberg, went to Hampton as well, right, Mom? So you want to talk about, let me ask you, because I actually wanted to do this type of show a long time ago where I interviewed my mom, but she didn't want to do it at the time. She doesn't remember. But I think since we're going in the last couple of minutes of the show, why don't you talk about why, because we don't want to leave you out, Mom.
No, you're not.
Why don't we want to, better not, why don't we talk about how you got ended up at WLIB? How did you end up at WLIB?
I don't have the slightest idea.
I know what she did to some people at WLIB.
Well, they shouldn't do what they... Anyway,
I'm sorry, Kay. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm thinking of Mary Baraka. He was so great, absolutely great. And there's a couple of stories about him that are really funny. But he was one of the brightest men, you know, with his books that he wrote, and then you know, putting on plays and whatnot. And that was at the time during the '60s. I think it was during the '60s or late '60s. When everything was going on, you know, with the riding and, you know, where we lived in the south border of Newark and whatnot. But that was a terrible time. And with Mary, he was involved with this, and it was, I'll tell you about a few stories about him and how he reacted to his wife. And it was funny one time because he was absolutely great. And it seems to be that one time that he was having a meeting with Gus, you know, and he was supposed to be meeting with his wife, Amina. And so he was late or something. And whoever it was, you know, called, and then they said, and tell him, if you don't get your short so-and-so home, you know, pick me up. But that was so funny. But anyway, that's another thing. But he was really, really fantastic and very, very bright. And what a, you know, person who really made that movement move, you know, because Mary was absolutely, absolutely great. But also, another thing I'd like to mention, too, is Black Indian, all right? There's so much history of Black Indian that we don't even know anything about, you know? And that's where Bill Katz comes in. And let me see. Oh, and the first person that I went on stage with was, I think it was really an accident because I was not an actress or anything, but we did have a Thompson Dance Group, was Vi Higginson. When she did, what was the name of the
Mama
I Wanna Sing.
Right. Let me just chime in with about Mr. Baraka. Mr. Baraka went to school with my father and uncle. And as a senior in college, I asked my father I need to do a senior thesis, as you know, Byron. And my father arranged for me to interview Mary Baraka. And
right.
so this man, being an answer on tests that I took in college, who was my homeboy, was from Newark, who kind of gave me the notion that if he could do it, I could do it. Here's somebody from my neighborhood, from my area. And I interviewed him. I interviewed him at as a senior in college. And I was able to interview him and do my senior with him, and he took a lot of time to give me a great interview, which I have on tape, which I mentioned to Raz, his son, that I'm going to share with him. But he was a Renaissance man in so many ways, and as you guys know, anybody who's seen or read The Dutchman, and just that type of play and his story is really, really pretty remarkable. I don't know if you guys performed that at Hampton, Byron. But, Baraka was—he was a powerhouse. And every time I had a chance to come home and see him and talk to him, we always kind of related from that perspective.
Sorry about
okay, and so that was the relationship that we had talking about a Mary Baraka. You wanted to say something
about
Oprah?
Oprah. When she first started out, you know, no one had heard of her. She went on Donahue's show.
Okay.
You know, and I think that he had heard about her, you know, being, you know. And during that time, she was up when she did the first show, when she took over for Donnie's first show.
Okay.
There was a group of KKK people in the audience.
Right.
If I remember correctly.
Right.
And she took them on.
Right.
And she just, you know,
right.
Very, very dignified. And ever since then, you know, I was really hooked on her.
Right.
You know, so that happened during that time. There also was a time when, let me see what happened. What about, there was something about Trump.
Okay.
But anyway, also Pearl Primus, and with my dance background, because I did have a Thompson Dance Studio.
Okay.
I met Pearl Primus. Okay. Also, Carmen de Lavallade. I didn't study dance under Carmen, but I was in awe of her. Okay? And so many different people that, you know, and Sandy Baraka, you know, Raz's sister,
right.
You know, came to the dance studio, which was a very good time. Was he on?
Let me just say, I wanted to point out that you also interviewed Sam Jackson as well as his wife, LaTanya.
Right.
LaTanya was doing a play at the Digger Ensemble Company, and I remember you describing a situation to me where she was not quite as open to you, and until you had mentioned, asked her if she knew me, and then she kind of changed up or softened up a little bit. We also, early on in his career, I was able to convince Sam to come and be on my mom's show, and so a lot of people came through there in terms of the black actors in theater, and that was the opportunity afforded to us through you at WLIB, through Wayne at WLIB, a lot of the people that you worked with, probably Byron as well, on a lot of those theater projects that helped, you know, during that time in New York, you know, NEC was, they were still happening a lot, but it was also a lot of the hot stories in New York from a news perspective. You guys, Wayne, at WLIB were covering a lot of that stuff, right? I mean, that was during Dave Dinkins' administration and things like that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Go ahead, Kay.
Yeah. There is another thing. I got the opportunity to interview, what's her name? You know.
Okay.
Rosa Parks.
Yeah, Rosa
right.
Parks.
I have a 17-minute interview that I did with Rosa Parks that I cherish, and one of these days I'm going to let people know. I may put it up sale or something like that. I may not.
Okay.
But really interesting stuff. Also, I interviewed Gus. Gus had Positively Blind.
Right.
And
right.
I've interviewed him a number of times, which is fascinating thing involving the city of Newark. That was built. Town, New Jersey Performing Arts Center was built.
Mm-hmm.
Without him, I doubt that New Jersey Performing Arts Center would have been built.
When you want to talk about briefly,
Eric,
one
of the things I just wanted to point out with respect to your mom is that the radio wars were pretty intense back in the late 1980s and 90s,
right.
And your mom played a pivotal role, you know, against people who were like Bob Grant and Sean Hannity. I mean, Grant is dead now and all that. But, I mean, the deal is that their political ideology and philosophy is still existent. And it just amazes me, you know, when you look back, because LIB has changed this direction and our history is lost to a certain extent. But those were the salad days for many of us coming into our own in terms of black radio, the importance and the significance of black radio, because you would hear things first on an LIB or even to a lesser extent Kiss FM, with regard to what was going on. And if Kay had said something on the air 1 hour, Bob Grant, who would follow her, would respond to it. And their listeners would call your mom the next day, you know, just almost as if they would wait for dead air to expire just to have an opportunity to respond to certain things that they felt were unjust, you know. But I don't know. I mean, the racial polarization factor is still there. It's just unfortunate that, you know, the signals are no longer existent to us. And it has nothing really to do with social media. I just think that, yes, social media has played a role and impacted on what has been traditional. But I also feel, to a certain extent, there's still a need and a demand for that immediacy that you just don't get, at least in this marketplace.
Right, and also, too, what you guys were able to do back then was really a daily content update of what was going on in the black community. There is no current, and also there is no current news source for black people or constant talk. I believe there are in certain parts of the country, a certain radio station, you know, Kathy Hughes with some of her radio stations. And,
yeah.
You know, you had the Tom Pointers and the other gentlemen, but there's not that pulse beat every day to almost 24 hours a day addressing issues. And, you know,
exactly.
Gary, my mom, the other brother whose name escapes me.
Mark Riley,
Mark
Lamb Pell.
Right, right. So you had, like, I mean, you guys were pretty much the precursor to talk to what's going on TV now,
yeah,
with the news channels. You know, they have every hour on the hour. And you look at MSNBC, all of these, Fox, even CNN, all of them have what you guys were doing on radio then. And we don't have the equivalent for a black television station to do that as you guys were doing. I mean, even WWRL, you guys, WWRL,
yeah,
keeping the pulse and the issues that were important to the black community going alive. You wanted to say real quick.
Yeah, I want to say something about Oprah. I first saw her when she was,
on the Donahue Show.
Yeah, on the Donahue Show, right. No, but I was going to mention Whoopi Goldberg, one of the brightest women in television as far as I'm concerned. You know, she has a history. And Glenn Taylor, you know, writes about her being so bright,
right,
and, you know, analyzing all these famous women, the famous singers and all that sort of thing. But let me see, I'm trying to find my notes. Let me know.
Okay.
Oh, when I didn't like Whoopi at the first time I saw her, you know,
Broadway.
In the theater on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the one who did put a white something
on her head,
mm-hmm, and started swishing it around,
right,
saying, "Ah, I left my long black hair. Luxurious hair."
Right.
She originated that.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And there's so many like that. One girl who was on Saturday Night Live, really funny lady right now, you know,
right,
getting it. But she was not able to originate that. That was Whoopi's word.
Okay.
So Whoopi Goldberg, one of the white of the whites, the brightest women in television.
Right.
On talk show.
Right. Started out on Broadway with a Broadway show,
right,
became a big, huge star. At one time, about to jump off, but I just wanted to point this out. Whoopi Goldberg, at one time, she was the highest paid female actress,
mm-hmm,
in Hollywood. And so that's something,
wow,
we talked about.
Right.
We ran out of time. Maybe we could do a part two, because we still have to get to the rest of your history, Byron, and also Wayne and my mom. Will talk about a couple of things that Wayne and you and my mom experienced during your radio days, because there were some pivotal stories. I'm thinking of Yusuf Hawkins and the whole situation when Dave Dinkins was mayor.
Yeah.
Dave Dinkins was there, and the situation in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. So there are a bunch of stuff. But we got to jump off now. We got about 60 seconds. Byron Saunders, our resident guest host. It's been very real, brother, knowing that you're a fellow pirate. And that's always a pleasure.
Peace and love.
All right, sir.
Peace and love, always.
Thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Yes.
Wayne Gilman, legendary newsman. I want to thank you for calling in. And
right. And I appreciate the build up, and I'm sorry that I just for some reason thinking today was Thursday. I don't know why. It's been like that all day, but you know. But it was good to be on.
Me too as well. All right, we'll talk to you soon, Wayne Gilman. Thanks. Listen to the Kate Thompson Live Show every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. We're archived. I'm the son, Eric Payne. You are.
I'm the mother, Kate Thompson.
All right.
Listen to Kate Thompson Live every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m.
All right. Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Well, I'll see.